From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the best investigative journalists is getting out of the business. NPR's Howard Berkus, I'm afraid to say, is retiring soon. So today in Radio West, we're taking the opportunity to talk to Howard about his remarkable career, which began with the massive explosion of Mount St. Helens. We'll talk about his coverage of rural America, the Olympics, the art of radio, and his last big project. Howard Berkus, in just a moment. Hey, podcast listeners, it's me again, and I just wanted to bring to your attention a new podcast that we're producing here at KUER. It's hosted and reported by the journalist Andrea Smarden, and she's been working on this for months now, trying to understand why it is we don't always get along very well. Basically, it's a podcast about finding connection, and we're going to be honest here, we're not entirely sure if we can find that connection. But each episode is going to end with this challenge where Andrea asks you to think about your own part in all of this. It's called Next Door Strangers, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can just go online to KUER.org. Thanks a lot. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You know how every once in a while you'll read or hear about something and wish that you had thought about it because it so perfectly captures a moment? There's this detail in a story by NPR's Howard Berkus that got me thinking like that. This was way back, 1999, and Howard was covering the ethics and bribery scandal involving International Olympic Committee officials. Salt Lake City, of course, had been caught up in all of this. And Howard had gone to Lausanne, Switzerland, headquarters for the IOC, to cover a meeting about the scandal and how leaders were proposing to fix the organization and their reputation. And he managed to find the perfect way to set the scene.
There's no better symbol here of what's at stake this week than the scene outside the white polished walls of the Olympic Museum, among pillars and fountains and pools of water. A workman sporting Olympic rings on his blue beret and blue jacket perches on the lips of a massive stone cauldron. He peers down the bronze cup at its center, popping up from time to time to reach for a wrench or some other tool. He's like a bird at a bird bath. Though it isn't water he seeks, it's fire, or the flow of gas at least, that lights this permanent Olympic torch. It's busted. He's trying to fix it.
It's a minor moment from a major scandal, but I've always thought it showed some of Howard's gifts as a reporter. Observation, his description, his writing, and he's a hell of an investigator, too. It also just so happens that Howard Berkus is retiring soon. So today in the program, we're talking with Howard about his life and his career and his last big project, another groundbreaking story, which has affected the lives of miners in coal country. For 20 years now, Howard Berkus has reported on the American West. He spent 10 years covering rural America, the past 8 years doing investigative reporting on workplace and coal mine safety. His work has been honored with 5 Edward R. Murrow Awards. He's earned numerous other awards for investigative reporting. He's a friend of ours, and he's joining us here in the studio. Lives here in Utah, of course. And Howard, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's great to be back.
Well, I'll come back to this a little bit later,
sure.
But how are you feeling right now as I'm reading on the air that you're retiring soon?
Yes, you are making me very uncomfortable, but I haven't had much chance to think about it because I'm still working on my last big project. We're doing a film for the PBS program Frontline that'll air on January 22nd, but it's not done yet, so we're still working on that, and I'll probably be working a few weeks past my official retirement date.
So you don't know what that's going to be like yet.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I do know that I'm going to go skiing during the week.
Yep.
And I'm going to go kayaking and canyoneering at times when there aren't a lot of other people there.
Yeah. That's the thing that's appealing is you get to go during the week this time, not
yes.
The weekend. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's back up. I want to start with your father. He was a local politician and pretty good at it, if I understand this right. And it seems like, and I'm wondering where your sense of engagement, even your sense of activism, I'm not sure that's quite the right word as a journalist, but I think it might be, did it come from home? Did it come from your dad?
My dad was a politician in, in southeastern Pennsylvania, in Bucks County. And we got five newspapers a day at our house. And in those days, there were morning papers, there were evening papers. And if I remember correctly, we had three in the morning and two in the evening. And I would pick up those papers and I'd lie on the floor. And instead of watching cartoons, I would read those newspapers. My dad got them because he wanted to keep track of what people were saying about him.
Yeah.
He was known as Boss Berkus, so that'll give you an idea of the kind of politics he was involved in. But I think something else I picked up from him and from my mom ran his local office, so she was the one who dealt with people. He was a state representative in the state house in Pennsylvania, the state assembly. He also eventually became the state's first drug czar. But when he was a state lawmaker, and even before that, when he was a township supervisor, we would get calls all the time at home from people who had problems wanting them fixed. And then my mom ran his office. So she was the one who got all the phone calls from people who needed help doing something. And it was her job to figure out how to do it. So from both of them, I sort of learned this, or I picked up this idea that when people need help, you can do something about it. You know, you could maybe help change their lives. And there were many instances, because I'm a kid and I'm listening to all this stuff, you know, especially when the phone is ringing at home constantly in the evening and it's calls from constituents. I hear, you know, problems getting solved. And so maybe that had something to do with it. You know, they both were about service to people. My dad loved politics. He loved the messiness of it. But, you know, it was all about trying to sort of fix things that were broken. And my mom helped with that. So yeah, maybe that's where I got it from.
Did you get your inclination for, I want to say pinning people to the wall, but asking really difficult questions? You've always done that as long as I've known you. Did you get that in some way from them, or did that just come?
So I think I got that not in quite the way you'd think of it. It's sort of from a negative way. Mm-hmm. So what I saw about politics that I didn't like was kind of the dishonesty of it. That one day the people who were your friends and doing things for you, the next day would become your enemies and would, you know, attack you. But also that I saw decisions were made not to benefit people but for political reasons. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was not the right way to do things. And I've never had much tolerance for politicians or elected officials who don't represent the people fairly and honestly, or don't say the honest things, you know.
Yeah.
And I have the least amount of patience for BS from politicians, elected officials, public servants,
mining officials, regulators.
Yeah. Especially in the regulatory realm, the job of a regulator is to protect the, you know, the people who they're in that industry or whatever it is. And I understand the challenges that those people face in terms of funding, resources, competing pressures from various places. But they have a duty to talk about what they do, and they have a duty to perform in a way that benefits the people that they're supposed to be protecting.
Yeah.
And they have a duty to hold to account the organizations, the companies, the people they're regulating. So there's a photo that I will not share with you, but I will describe for you, of me with the Assistant Secretary of Labor, David Zeteslo, at West Virginia University in September, where, you know, he wouldn't talk to us about this big project that we'll talk about in a little bit about coal mining.
Yep.
And so we decided to go to him. He had a rare public appearance at the university, was speaking to mining students. During his speech, he said one thing about the subject we were focused on. We went up to him afterwards, and he said completely the opposite. And somebody took a picture of me and him together. And, you know, we both have our arms folded, and I'm like, you know, my eyebrows are furrowed, and I'm kind of have this angry look on my face, and I'm a little taller than him, and I'm peering down at him, and maybe that captures like my attitude.
Yeah,
it's not a very flattering photograph, but
but it conveys a general sense of the way you feel about all of this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But what were you seeing as you laid out these newspapers as a kid, when you should have been watching cartoons? Like, was it about the story itself or the process of the reporting part? I mean, what was it about the newspapers that was so interesting to you, do you think?
What I remember reading the most was a column in the Philadelphia Bulletin by Jack Anderson.
Wow.
And it was an investigative reporting column.
Yeah.
You know, and he was a muckraker.
Yep.
And he has a Utah connection, I believe,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Isn't he from Utah?
Mormon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I, of course, I didn't know any of that. But I loved reading those columns. And I remember lying on the floor, you know, with the bulletin folded out. And that was the one thing I went to, you know, first every day. And it was because he was holding people accountable, I guess. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I like that idea of reading where somebody has found out things about somebody else that needed to be exposed. And, you know, and here was Jack Anderson doing that day after day. So, you know, I've never thought about it, that whether that was my origin story or not, but that's the one thing I religiously read in among those newspapers.
You, didn't become a journalist right away. In fact, I think you've talked about you became one kind of reluctantly, at least at first.
Well, I had another career. I was flailing about trying to figure out what I was going to do. I was a community organizer, like Barack Obama.
Yeah.
But
which makes sense, I have to say, when you talk a little bit about your history, like the idea of service and helping people.
It's sort of a sense of mission.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I ended up not being interested so much in journalism as the art of radio. So I'd moved to Oregon and quit my job there to volunteer at KLCC in Eugene. And
can I just underline that? Quit your job to volunteer.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was a really stupid thing to do. and you know, and I never got a dime from KLCC, but the only way to make money was to sell stuff to NPR.
Yeah.
And I figured that out pretty quick. And they were desperate for material, especially from the West. So it wasn't too hard to get my new spots on the air and newscasts, and then to started getting assignments. But what transfixed me at first was not so much the journalism and the reporting, but the art of radio, the power of the human voice, the ability to recreate scenes with sound, and to make those scenes come alive with evocative writing. That's what I was actually quite interested in. Radio artists don't make money, though. You know, and so I was doing reporting, you know, to support that artistic kind of approach. But in that reporting at KLCC, I had my first investigative story that sort of fell in my lap. There was an academic credit scandal going on across the country at that time, where athletes, usually football players, were getting credit for courses they didn't attend. And this had been a big story across the country. And at the University of Oregon in Eugene, where I was, it turns out that this had gone down. Not only did this happen in the football team, but it happened in the wrestling team and the swimming team, which seemed kind of odd. They're lower profile sports, but somebody dropped that in my lap, and I reported that. And boy, that was exciting, reporting something that nobody else had, and then seeing, you know, the story quoted in the Associated Press and then in the local newspaper, and triggering a huge response at the university. Wow. And that was pretty exciting. And I think that's when I got hooked on the idea of reporting being something that was really special and exciting. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than breaking news.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about a story. One of the big stories that you covered from 1980. This was May, of course, 1980. Mount St. Helens erupts, and the way you wrote about it, you said the precise moment was marked by a sound, by this supersonic boom. You say 8:32 a.m. This was May 18th, 1980. And you say in your piece that you immediately sensed what happened. What was the sense of what was going on? I'm trying to imagine your first view of the mountain, which you've described before. It seems extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I sensed it happened because I had been covering these little burps and small eruptions of Mount St. Helens for a few months. If I remember correctly, in March of 1980, the first little burst of steam and ash came out of the top of the mountain, and that was a big story. I remember getting into an airplane and flying over while an eruption took place, a small one. These were really small eruptions. And we knew, and I had been up on the mountain at the end of April in 1980, going up a timberline where the geologists were monitoring the mountain, and it was shaking constantly. There was constant ash fall, and it was the scientists were measuring the mountain deforming, you know, bulging.
Wow.
So there was an expectation that something was going to happen. So, you know, I'm on May 18th in the morning, I'm in bed in this little tiny A-frame in Eugene, which is, you know, over 100 miles away from Mount St. Helens, and there's this boom. And I immediately got up and I said, it's happened. I said this to myself, and I ran down to the radio station. And sure enough, you know, the wire copy is, the news wire is spitting out all this stuff about this incredible eruption that took place. It was a day before I got there and was driving up this closed road. I talked myself past the police checkpoints and was driving along the Cowlitz River, I believe it was, which has mountains on the side. So you can't see St. Helens for a while as you're approaching. And then all of a sudden I go around a bend and there is the mountain and just pouring out this volcanic ash and these clouds going up, you know, 60,000 feet in the sky with blue lightning flashing in. It was the most incredible thing I've ever seen.
Let me play a kind of an excerpt from some of Howard's coverage and some of the reaction he was getting to it.
It just started blowing, and it just looked like the whole top of the mountain just exploded into one black ball, and it just kept growing and growing.
A searing hot flow of ash, gas, and rocks poured from the summit crater and rushed down the mountainside. As the flow reached timberline, trees were pushed over like toothpicks.
And everything is covered with either white or gray ash. There are tree falls as much as 15 miles away from the top of the mountain.
Mudslides have already created a 20-foot-high wall of water on one river. Evacuations of nearby towns are continuing.
All of the roads in eastern Washington are closed. Schools are closed, airports are closed, mail service has been stopped.
Five people are now reported dead as a result of this morning's eruption.
What was it like covering a story like that? And all this phone tape. That's what it was like in those days.
You know, you carried around alligator clips with you and a canning jar wrench so that you could unscrew the mouthpiece on payphones, hook up the alligator clips to your tape recorder and to the phone, and follow your stories. That's how we did. There was one night I had to wake somebody up at 3 o'clock in the morning at a motel. The owner wake them up to use their phone to file a story. It was, you know, I was completely green as a reporter. I had covered a couple of stories for NPR on a short turnaround basis. Had done some features, done a lot of news spots, but I had never been a part of what was one of the biggest stories of the century. You know, I was astonished that the editor at NPR assigned that story to me, And I found out later the reason was, you know, Ira Flatow was the science correspondent at NPR, and he had just covered the Three Mile Island nuclear accident and wasn't really interested in doing another big story. So that's why I got assigned to do it. You know, I have Ira to thank for my career. It was, you know, I was just winging it the whole way. I did what the other reporters did. I asked the questions I thought, you know, needed to be asked. I looked for something I've always done in my career is I looked for how real people were being affected and, as much as possible. And I was, you know, what was, pretty difficult was managing deadlines for two shows, Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And in those days, there was no such thing as like sending a producer or anything like that. I did have some
Morning Edition was brand new.
Morning Edition had just gone on the air the year before in November of 1979. And so it was a 24-hour deadline with very little opportunity to sleep. I think I probably didn't sleep for the first 3 days.
Wow.
And I did get some help from one of my colleagues who came up, and we worked together, and that was that helped some. But it was just you were just chasing, you know, one thing after another. A few days in, President Jimmy Carter showed up, and I talked my way onto the helicopter sort of motorcade, you know, that followed him as he went up to look at the mountain. And we got these just it's hard to describe what that mountain did. You know, you had chunks of ice from the glacier on Mount St. Helens that were, as big as office buildings floating down rivers and houses floating down rivers and logging trucks. And then, as we heard in that audio, this vast old growth Douglas fir forest just mowed over like toothpicks. It was astonishing, and I couldn't believe I was involved in it. And I there's one thing I got to tell you is when the helicopter motorcade sort of landed, and we all get out, all the reporters, and the president has his own helicopter, and he gets out, Jimmy Carter, and we're all just standing on the tarmac, and I'm standing there with my microphone out, and all of a sudden he makes a beeline right for me, and he reaches me, and all the Secret Service is like freaked out because there are these like hundreds of reporters surrounding me and Jimmy Carter, and I'm there with my microphone, you know, and the Secret Service is around us, and the other reporters are trying to get their mics in. I was so stunned I couldn't think of anything to say. And somebody screamed out, "What did you think, Mr. President?" You know? And that's when he said, somebody said it looks like the moon, and he said it makes the moon look like a golf course.
Wow. That's a good line.
Yeah. You know, I just couldn't believe that. I have to say that I was better dressed than Jimmy Carter was that day.
How old were you?
God, I don't know. 1980, I was, I have to think about this for a minute.
You're in your 20s?
Yeah, I was in my 20s, yeah. 26? I'll have to figure it out.
But, well, there you are in the thick of it.
But in the thick of it, and that was addictive. That was completely addictive. I mean, there was no going back after that.
Howard Berkus, he's an investigative reporter, of course, for NPR. We have a link to his extensive body of work on our website, radiowest.org. He's not leaving yet, but soon. That's why we're talking to him. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. NPR's Howard Berkus is retiring soon. I hate to say, one of the best investigative journalists really in the business. And so today in the program, we're taking the opportunity to talk to Howard about his really impressive career. We'll spend a little bit of time also on his last big project. Probably have him back to talk more about that because a lot of details there. Howard's joining us here in the studio. First big breaking story, although I guess it was Mount St. Helens, but another one of them, of course, was the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion. This was in 1986. How did you come to this story? What was your connection to this? How did you get assigned to this?
Well, of course, the problem with the Challenger blowing up was related to the booster rockets that lifted the Challenger into space. Yeah. And the booster rocket manufacturer at the time, Morton Thiokol, is outside of Brigham City, Utah. So right from the explosion, I was assigned to do stories about what was going on at Thiokol, what were the reactions by people in Brigham City. You know, there was some blaming going on at the time of people blaming Thiokol. And in the midst of that, I got a phone call one day with a tip that told me that the engineers at Thiokol had tried to stop the launch the night before Challenger was launched and that they were overruled. Actually, the tip was that they were coerced by NASA to approve the launch. And I immediately that tip included.
That's a hell of a tip.
It was a big tip, and it included names of which engineers, of two of the engineers. And I called them up at home, and one of them actually talked to me for a little bit, but off the record. You know, I don't want to be recorded. Can't use my name. And basically confirm that skeleton of a story that we were hearing. And I pursued that for, I'm trying to remember the timing, I think it was a week or so. Didn't get terribly far. Did get the wife of the second engineer who, you know, said, confirmed the situation as well. But we didn't have much to go on. We didn't have details.
Yeah.
No other. There was a little bit of reporting nationally. The New York Times had reported that there was an argument the night before Challenger was launched. And what eventually happened is that one day I was actually heading up to Brigham City to do a story about people reacting. And I got a call from an NPR editor who said, "Okay, we're doing this today. We're putting Danny Zwerdling onto this and you're onto this. And we have names, phone numbers, of all the engineers, who we think were involved in that discussion the night before the launch and the managers. And so
go find them.
Hmm. And one of those engineers whose wife I had spoken with, Danny had called, that engineer spoke with, his wife. And she said, this was Roger Beaujolais, by the way.
Yeah.
He's in a hotel room in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Marshall Space Flight Center. So Danny hopped on a plane and I drove up to Brigham City. And, you know, remember, no cell phones in those days.
Yeah.
We didn't have laptops. No Google. I went to the public library with a list of the engineers and I got their home phone numbers and addresses.
Wow.
Up
there in Brigham City?
In Brigham City.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
I went to the public library and then started knocking on doors. Didn't have much luck. I remember knocking on the door of one of the Thiokol managers and probably about 10 or 15 business cards fell out of the crack in the door from reporters from all over the world.
Yeah.
So we weren't the only ones pursuing this.
Right.
But one door did open, and that was the house of Bob Ebling,
yeah,
who was still at work. Darlene, his wife, very sweet woman, let me use the phone. No cell phones. I hadn't talked to my editor all day. I asked if I could use the phone.
Gosh.
And then I was there when Bob Ebling came home from work, and he was not very happy to see a reporter sitting at his kitchen table. But he was.
But he did talk to you.
He was incredibly distressed. He felt incredibly guilty, and he just would not stop talking. And at first, he wouldn't let me take notes. You know, I couldn't record him, couldn't name him, but he wouldn't even let me take notes. He was so afraid that that would, you know, result in him being found out and fired. But after a while, I said, look, I'm not going to get any of this right if I can't at least take notes.
Yeah.
And what Danny got at that hotel room in Huntsville, Alabama with Roger Beaujolais, and what I got from Bob Ebling at his house in Brigham City, these were identical stories. There were a couple of details. They weren't different. They were just, I got some details that Danny didn't and vice versa. They were identical stories, right down to the hour, the minute, the exact language that people used. Now, we didn't know this. Again, we don't have cell phones. We're not communicating with each other. And it wasn't until later that evening when we both ended up at our own, at hotel rooms, and we called into our editor and we started comparing notes, that we realized what we had was not only dramatic and unbelievable, because what they described was how they were essentially badgered into changing their recommendation of no launch. You know, they knew it was going to be a problem. They had the data to show it. They presented it. They ran into nothing but resistance from the NASA people involved. And their own managers, who had supported the engineers at first in a recommendation of no launch, reversed themselves under pressure from NASA. And Darlene, Bob Ebling's wife, told me that when Ebling came home the night before Challenger was launched, after this, you know, this meeting, this this confrontational meeting at Morton Thiokol with the NASA people, that his first words were, "It's going to blow up." And then the next morning, his daughter, one of his daughters, who was an adult daughter at the time, also worked at Thiokol, and they were all together, you know, watching the launch. But on the way to work, they went to work together. She told me later, many years later, that he was pounding his fist, you know, on the dashboard. They're all going to die. It's going to blow up. They're all going to die. And when it did, you know, he and Beaujolais were sitting in a conference room with other Thiokol engineers, and Beaujolais just broke into tears. And Bob, who was a very religious man, prayed. But they knew exactly what happened.
In 2016, you did a story sort of revisiting this with Bob Ebling. Here's a moment from the piece that you produced, and this was January of 2016.
Ebling retired soon after Challenger. He suffered deep depression and has never been able to lift the burden of guilt. He still feels, as he told me in 1986, he should have and could have done more. Sitting in a big easy chair in his living room, his eyes watery and his face grave, Ebling concludes he was inadequate. He just didn't argue the data well enough, he says. He's prayed about this for the last 30 years.
And I think that was one of the mistakes that God made. He shouldn't have picked me for that job. I don't know. But next time I talk to him, I'm going to ask him, why me? You picked a loser.
I remind Ebling what his late colleague and friend Roger Beaujolais once said. Beaujolais was the other Thiokol engineer who spoke with NPR anonymously 30 years ago. They were talking to the right people, Beaujolais once told me. They were talking to the people who had the power to stop that launch, and they did all they could. Maybe, Ebling says to me with a weak wave as I leave, maybe Roger's right.
What's so interesting is the way this story turns and how producing that piece creates this groundswell that offers comfort for Bob Ebling in the last days of his life. That must have been a remarkable twist for a story like that.
I was so I had kept in touch with both Roger Beaujolais, who died, I think, in 2012, and Bob Ebling over the years. every once in a while, you know, every few years. So I knew how difficult this was for Bob Ebling, but he became this savior of the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge after flooding there. In the 1980s, he became this volunteer who raised money for the refuge, and he put his life into, you know, into helping the wildlife there at the refuge, the birds. And he was honored nationally. He went to the White House, you know, for that work. And so I had this idea that, well, maybe that helped him get over, you know, what happened with Challenger or understand it in a different way. And I would call him up on anniversaries to see if he was willing to talk about it. And on the 30th anniversary of Challenger in 2016, the day before, I said to my editor, you know, I'm thinking about calling up this engineer again. You know, what do you think? And he goes, what do you mean, what do I think? Do it.
Yeah. How old is Bob?
He was 89.
Yeah.
And so I called him up and, you know, he said, yeah. Come on up. I'll talk to you now. Yeah, we could do this. And so I rushed up there. And, you know, I was – the house hadn't changed in 30 years. Wow. The same kitchen table. The kitchen was set up the same way. There was – you know, there were some things there, like these sort of parallel bars going from the kitchen to the living room so that he had a way to get there without his wheelchair. But a lot, you know, a lot hadn't changed, and he hadn't changed. And that really shocked me that he still felt that way.
Yeah.
And when listeners heard those words, that God had chosen a loser, the response was astounding. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people wrote in, most of them saying, you know, trying to offer words of comfort. A lot of engineers wrote in and said, you know, as engineers, it's our job to present the data. We don't make the decisions. Other people do that. We do the best we can with the data. You have nothing to feel guilty about. Mm-hmm. And so I went back. Bob couldn't read anymore. His eyesight was too bad. So I would send these emails and letters to his daughter, who would read them to him. And then I would go up there and I'd read some to him. And especially there was one letter in particular from one engineer. And I thought, you know, I went back, he was hearing these letters. I was reading some to him and it still didn't make a difference to him. And I was kind of shocked. And he said, well, I've never heard from Thiokol and I've never heard from NASA. And, so I dredged up one of the NASA officials who overruled those engineers that night, who has never spoken publicly.
Is it George Hardy?
George Hardy.
Yeah.
Actually, George did speak publicly at one time, didn't say much, but I did reach him. He didn't want to talk to me on tape, but he felt an obligation to call Bob Ebling, and he did. And I also found one of the Thiokol managers who overruled the engineers. Same thing. Didn't want to talk to me about it, but, you know, said he would call Ebling. And then I talked to Alan McDonald, who was a Thiokol manager, but was with the engineers and worked with the engineers to try to stop the launch. And he called Ebling as well. And then I called NASA and just said, you know, this guy has had this guilt for all these years, and no one from NASA has ever contacted him. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah.
I'd like to interview the administrator about it. They wouldn't do an interview, but they did issue a statement.
Yeah.
And in the statement, they essentially said, I'll paraphrase, that the space program needed more people like Bob Ebling, who, you know, was there to protect astronauts. And I read that to him, that statement. And
let me play this moment.
All right.
This is a story that Howard produced February 25th of 2016.
Bravo! I've had that same thought many, many times.
Ebling is now more buoyant than at any time I've seen or talked to him in the last 30 years, despite cancer and hospice care. He'll pray again for God's assessment, he says, when our interview ends. I ask one more question. Is there anything he'd like to say to the people who wrote to him?
Thank you. You helped bring my worrisome mind to ease. You have to have an end to everything.
And as I leave, Bob Ebling smiles, raises his hands above his head, and claps. Kathy Ebling calls that a miracle.
And he died a few weeks later.
Yeah. What a nice coda for a story like that. I mean, it seems so rare, Howard. You begin this story with this horrible disaster. I mean, for a reporter to see the trajectory sort of come to a close like that, that's kind of nice.
I don't know really what to say about it, because it's not like I thought of, you know, you can't anticipate anything like that.
Of course.
I just wanted to see what perspective he might have on this disaster on the 30th anniversary. And of course, the perspective he had was the most important perspective of all. And he helped the rest of us see it in a completely different way, see it through his eyes, and understand more about that concept of responsibility and guilt. But personally, you know, for him and his family, it was a very important moment. And I've talked to his daughter, Kathy, since. She calls me bro, which is a term of honor for me. And she said it just completely changed him in the weeks, those final weeks of his life. His condition, his physical condition, did deteriorate quite a bit. But that he smiled, he was happy, he seemed relieved that the burden had been lifted. And, you know, we have some of the most amazing listeners in public radio who reached out to him, who felt affected by what he was saying, one human being to another, essentially. That's what this medium can do of radio. And they reached out to him. And I was maybe a vessel for getting it done, but they were the ones who made it happen.
Howard, I wanted to ask you about, so I think a lot of us know you've covered rural issues.
Mm-hmm.
How much of the coverage of rural issues, how much of that was related to your own connection to rural places? Like, how do you describe that? And because it seems like one of the themes in your work has been this connection with, like, I'm thinking about coal miners, of course, which is the last big project, which we don't have a lot of time to talk about. We're going to have Howard back, which will be a treat, and we'll really dig into the story because it's remarkable. You've spent some time on Morning Edition. You talked on 1A yesterday, so people know some of the basics. But what interests me is just your connection to folk on the ground, and that seems important to you, I guess. Is that fair to say?
Well, to me, there's no story worth doing if there aren't sort of real people affected in some way, and you got to talk to them about what it is that's affected them. And I have to tell you, it's not easy being a reporter parachuting in from a national news organization into Appalachia, mm-hmm. Which has been the subject of stereotypical stories. This continues to happen to this day from reporters who know nothing about the region and who only come in with these what are usually dismissive and demeaning stereotypes of the place and the people. Lately, it's to do stories about why do they vote for Trump kind
yep.
of thing.
Yep. Yep.
And it's hard. You know, it's hard trying to get people to talk to you. You have to be persistent and you have to show that you care about what they're talking about. And in any case, when it comes to Black Lung, however, it's a little bit different because the miners who are suffering feel ignored. And so when somebody wants to ask them about what their lives are like with the disease and what happened in their mining careers, they're actually anxious to talk about it, especially if you're willing to sit and spend time with them. And, you know, we interviewed 34 coal miners for this story, all of whom have progressive massive fibrosis, the advanced stage of black lung, all of whom are going to die horrible deaths and are suffering already from the effects of that disease. And those, you know, those people don't have much of a voice otherwise.
Can I mention, I have to say, there was a comment in yesterday's 1A show that Joshua Johnson read from a listener that drove me nuts. And it was someone who said something to the effect of, well, they should have gotten an education, these guys. They should have gotten a PhD, I think was the stupid, smug comment. It drives me crazy, I have to say. Right. What did you make of that? Like, well, if they would have gone to school, they wouldn't be in that mine and they wouldn't be in this circumstance.
Right. Well, only someone who comes from a position of privilege could actually say something like that and believe it about people that they would know nothing about.
Yeah.
And but that is not an uncommon kind of reaction that I get to my stories involving minors. For one, I don't know what it is in our society these days, but the first thing that many people think of is it's their own fault, and they look for a reason to blame them instead of blaming a system or looking at the real causes. For anybody to think that any single minor is responsible for the disease that is killing them shows a complete lack of understanding of the culture of Appalachia, the power of coal mining, the imbalance of power that occurs between miners and mine owners, and the failure of regulation. So, yeah, that infuriated me too, and I was going to make sure that we had a chance to address it, and I did, and Davit McAteer, the former Assistant Secretary of Mine Labor and Health, also had a good point as well about the powerlessness of miners. But, hey, I couldn't afford to go to college. I mean, and I don't have a college degree. And I never in my wildest dreams would ever have thought that I could have, like, gone to graduate school or gotten a doctorate or something. I mean,
or had a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard.
Well, but these are things that, and you know, and I'm white, and I didn't grow up. You know, we were, you know, my dad was a politician, but he didn't get paid much. You know, we lived in a lower middle class kind of area, and we didn't have a lot.
Yeah.
But I did have white privilege, and I had more opportunities than most people, and I still didn't have those things. So for somebody to think that somebody raised in a holler in Appalachia who works in a coal mine can simply walk out one day, move across the country, and get a doctorate degree is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And it's a shame. I really feel bad that the climate in this country is such that people aren't willing to understand and learn more before coming to these conclusions, which essentially are just like a way to blame the individual for something that is completely beyond their power.
Are you going to miss this?
I haven't had any chance to think about it because
you're still working. Yeah.
Because I've been so involved in this story and it's been a completely consuming project, and I still have more work to do on it. You know, I've got probably another month of work before the Frontline story airs. So I haven't, will I miss it? Probably. I mean, yeah. I won't miss the deadlines, and this is very intense work.
Yes.
And it's incredibly
stressful.
Is
it emotionally
stressful.
Challenging?
Well, yeah.
I mean, hearing those stories, honestly.
It is, but you know, what I learned a long time ago is that when I stick a microphone in somebody's face, now if they don't want to talk to me, that's great. And
yeah.
I walk away. But often they do, and it's a gift. It's a gift to give somebody a voice and then to tell their story, you know, in a way that honors their lives, their perspective, their truth. That's a gift. And especially when it comes to public policy, where almost all of the discussion occurs in a vacuum. It's just the policymakers, the politicians, the activists, you know, they're all jabbering away. Mm-hmm. And we don't hear enough from the people who are actually affected by those things. And that was the power of this story, and in many of the stories I've done,
yeah.
is that I've always focused on, okay, who's affected? How are they affected? Why did it happen this way? And I bring in the voices of whether it's industry or government or whomever it is, you know, for accountability.
But it's about the people who are affected.
That's right.
But do you think how I was thinking about this morning? You've had a lot of stories. I think this is unique among some reporters. Stories that have had actual impact, congressional hearings, actual policy change. And do you think it's because you focused on the actual stories of people that made the difference?
I don't think with this most recent story, you can turn away from the voices of those miners.
Yeah.
You know, the miners saying, I'm going to die from this. I think that's what makes the difference. I think that's what motivated that member of Congress who's the incoming chair of the House Labor Committee, House Education and the Workforce Committee to call hearings. And I think that the further away we get from the people who are affected, the easier it is for policy to not do them justice. And for policymakers, members of Congress, and for industry and for regulators to not do the things they should do to protect them. And that's, you know, everything. By the way, everything I reported, there's nothing new about anything I reported in this series. Absolutely nothing new. It's all been known for at least, you know, more than 20 years. The danger's been known, you know, back to Pliny the Elder, who wrote about this stuff.
Right.
So there's nothing new. What I brought to it new was data, you know, facts from documents, but most importantly, the experiences of the miners involved. And we gave them a lot of time on the air to tell their stories. And there'll be more of it on Frontline, and it'll be equally shocking, if not more so.
Yeah. I'm glad you'd be willing to come back and talk about that.
Absolutely.
Let me speak on behalf of some listeners and say thanks for your work over the years.
Well, thanks for your support for that work.
Howard Berkus, NPR's investigative reporter for now. He's going to retire soon after 38 years as a journalist at NPR. Howard, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Roddy Nikpur directed the show today. Produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.